Amen. Well, our text this morning will be Exodus chapter 20. Exodus chapter 20. We're working through the Ten Commandments, and we've been using this imagery of the tracks or the rails as our metaphor, and Kendra's helped us with this beautiful painting to reflect on that theme. We've talked about how the train is most free when it is on the tracks. The rails, in a sense, are restrictive to the train, but in a good way. Right? A train off the tracks is not a pretty picture. And the same is true with God's law. God's law is intended for human flourishing. We are at our best. We are most free when we are functioning under God's guidelines and restrictions. God's loving guidelines and gracious restrictions. So we've been thinking and having our minds sort of tuned as we think in those lines. Norman Rockwell is undoubtedly a familiar name for you. I'm probably dating myself a little bit, although his work is somewhat iconic. It endures. He's an artist. And he conveys powerful truth through this picture here. You see the butcher and this elegant lady, you know, she's buying a turkey for Thanksgiving dinner. And of course, you catch the subtleties in the picture, right? You see him slyly pushing down on the scale. And of course, she is pushing up on the scale. Each seem pretty pleased with themselves. They're getting the best of this transaction, right? As they look up to see what the weight of the turkey is. And this, I think, is a pretty good imagery to think about this whole arena of stealing, which is where the command directs us this morning. Certainly, these two fine, upstanding individuals would not consider themselves to be thieves. Here's this well-known butcher in the community, and here's this elegant lady who, again, in all terms seem to be good upstanding citizens, but they are thieves. They are both in the process of trying to take what is not theirs, to manipulate the other person for their own advantage. Part of the irony in all of this was that this picture appeared on the cover of the Saturday Evening Post, October 31st, 1936, right in the midst of the Great Depression. And my grandma never stopped talking about the Great Depression. It impacted, I've mentioned to you her using underwear elastic to hold the board games together. I mean, nothing was thrown out. I never got a new card from my grandma. It was always a recycled card. She would cross off what someone else had written, and she would jot her own note and send it in the mail to me. This was the Depression. I'm sure there could have been any number of reasons or rationales by which they would have justified their behaviors. Right? Business is really hard. I'm about ready to lose the store, right? Or maybe this woman thinks, well, this guy's a merchant. Certainly he can afford to, you know, he can afford to donate a little to my cause. we think about the different ways that our minds work and the different ways in which we try to get ahead and the tendency to try to get ahead at someone else's expense. The text we're going to look at, a very brief verse, Exodus 20, verse 15. Hear the word of the Lord. You shall not steal. You shall not steal. Might be that you're looking at this as another one that's an easy check off the box, right? You've never been convicted of shoplifting, right? No armed robberies in your criminal record. And so you're like, finally one that I can sort of take a breath, right? But we've been learning as we've explored the various commandments and as we've looked at Jesus' interpretation of the commandments, right? We find ourselves feeling a lot less confident and a lot less comfortable. Realizing that these commands have implications, they're pointing us somewhere, and that God is concerned not just with the outward act of taking something, a physical object, but God is concerned at the level of the heart. And so we have to think through what all is implicated by this very simple command, you shall not steal. Now, we've also been taking the opportunity to review. So let's do that here. Once, I'll give you some help, and then the second time through, you're on your own. All right? So, number one, no other gods. Number two, no carved image. Number three, no misuse of the divine name. Number four, remember the Sabbath. Number five, honor your parents. Number six, no murder. Number seven, no adultery. Number eight, no stealing. All right, you're on your own. And you can do this at home. I trust this isn't the only time you're going over this, right? Every morning. You're mumbling, but you're mumbling louder today. Okay, this is good. Some of you, it's still just the lips. You're not real confident. Kind of put yourself out there, but I appreciate the effort this morning. Okay. Number one, no other gods. Number two, no carved image. Number three, remote misuse of the divine name. Number four, remember the Sabbath. Number five, honor your parents. Number six, no murder. Number seven, no adultery. Number eight, no stealing. So if we were to break this down, pretty easy one to define. To steal is to take something without permission and in secret. And I've chosen to just sort of emphasize that aspect of secrecy or duplicity. Something sort of underhanded is going on, right? It's the subtle shift of that butcher's finger onto the scale as they're looking at the readout. That is something that's inherent in this particular concept. There's an account in Genesis 31 of Jacob and his father-in-law Laban that I feel like sort of illustrates the nuance of this term. We know that Laban was not really very kind or very fair to his son-in-law Jacob. And finally, Jacob had had enough, and he decided to take his wives, Laban's daughters, and the rest of his family and leave. And he did so under cover of darkness. He didn't even say goodbye. And when Laban finds out about it, he goes in pursuit of Jacob, and there's this really tense confrontation, and they accuse one another. Laban says, why did you take or steal, here's our word, why did you steal my household idols? Now, Jacob didn't realize it, but Rachel, his wife, had taken Laban's household idols. Secretly, covertly, right? That's the point. She snuck off with them. Jacob's response is interesting. He says, well, you know, I left like this and I didn't say goodbye because I was concerned that you would steal or take your daughters back from me by force, openly, right? Armed robbery. that's a very different... Both of them are stealing, right? Both concepts are stealing or taking. But the one is very brash and overt and in your face, and the other is... has this idea of stealth, something that's very underhanded, very slippery. Okay, that's the idea that's being confronted here, is this slippery, underhanded, secretive, manipulative way of taking what isn't yours, manipulating someone else for your advantage. Now, this would include overt things like burglary or robbery or larceny or hijacking or shoplifting or pickpocketing, if that's a word, purse snatching, right? All of those little sleights of hand of ways of people taking things, robbing others. It would also include what we might call kind of white-collar forms of stealing, embezzlement, fraudulent taking of money or other goods entrusted to one's care. So you might have a position of authority. You might be a principal or a superintendent. And you might have access to funds. And so you begin to kind of scrape off the top. That's embezzlement. It's stealing, but it's a very sort of nuanced form of stealing. Extortion. Getting money from someone by means of threats or misuse of authority. So this is how the mafia made their money, right? If you pay me a certain amount per month, I will help protect your business. If you don't pay me that amount, I can't guarantee that your business will be safe. Right? We all know what's going on there, right? So that's extortion. And then racketeering, obtaining money by any illegal means. So we have all these things that are pretty well known in our society. Scripture certainly lists out like examples or case studies as well that would certainly fall under this prohibition. And I've listed out just a few of them along with scripture references here. The stealing of people. We don't generally think of that, but kidnapping or slavery. Matter of fact, some have contended that it's really the main thrust of this particular command. I mean, God had just finished saying that He had delivered them out of slavery, right? They were free. And so God's saying, in essence here, don't enslave one another ever again. And you go on in Exodus 21, just the next chapter, and there's a lot of outlines about this very thing of kidnapping, of stealing people. And this very word is used in the immediate context. So it very well could be that this is a predominant thing that's going on here in this particular command. We also have the moving of boundary markers. We have all sorts of really technical ways now of sort of measuring property lines. And now, of course, with GPS, you can track all that stuff in different ways and calculate it with more exactness. But in the ancient world, there would generally be a big rock that marked the dividing point between my property and your property. And if I just picked up that rock and moved it about 10 feet that way, that's giving me extra crops, right? But it's causing me to get ahead at your expense. That's the problem. That's where the thievery comes in. The use of false measures. You know, again, we have digital scales and things, but using weights that are intentionally too light so that you're giving people less for their money. It's a form of stealing, selling goods of inferior quality. The prophet Amos addressed this or confronted the people of Israel about this very thing. Various mechanisms by which they sold people something that was not what it was advertised to be. We would say false advertising, right? That's a form of stealing. Charging exorbitant interest, or the old terminology of usury. Really keeping someone over a barrel, as it were, when they owe you money and you charge them such exorbitant interest that they really can't recover. They can't get out of their indebtedness. The devouring of widows' houses, very interesting. This was Jesus' critique of the religious leaders who were in positions of authority and were dependent on the people for their own support, and yet could often abuse, and often did abuse, that authority and would exact things from people, sometimes people who were in very vulnerable positions themselves, like widows. The withholding of wages. James talks about this. People who've done work and then you don't pay them. So these would just be various examples or case studies. Now, we know that, again, it can be much more subtle than this. Martin Luther noted, he said, there are gentlemen swindlers. How's that for an oxymoron? There are gentlemen swindlers or big operators, far from being picklocks and sneak thieves who loot a cash box. They sit in office chairs and are called great lords and honorable, good citizens, and yet with a great show of legality, they rob and steal. So Luther's addressing the fact that oftentimes stealing doesn't look like stealing. It's not obvious or readily apparent. And so we have to stretch our thinking a little bit to think about what would fall into this, even in a modern context, in a modern age. Person steals when they underpay their taxes. or underreport their income. A person steals when they take towels from the hotel. Person steals when they take goods or services they don't qualify for. You know, falsifying a document so that you can get this certain coverage. Person steals when they borrow and don't pay back. A person steals from a client when they overbill for services rendered. Person steals from their employer when they use office supplies for personal use, surf the web on company time, or pad their expense account. Retail stores report $8 billion in inventory shortages each year. My mind automatically goes to shoplifting, right? This is people stealing things off the shelves that are not theirs and that they didn't pay for. But the truth is that 60% of those losses are attributed to employee theft. They're inside jobs. People who may be rationalized as saying, you know, I am so mistreated. I get the short end of the stick. They shorted me on my paycheck last week. And so whatever that that thought process is, they're going to get back. They're going to settle the score. Fraudulent returns is becoming a major issue for stores. A $16 billion a year problem. A person buys the item, uses it for an event, and then returns it. Or buys it, mistakenly breaks it, and then takes it back, saying it was defective. Any action that involves the manipulation of another human being for personal gain violates the spirit of this prohibition. Of course, we could talk in our culture about intellectual property, right? We have concepts and ways of thinking about property that go beyond just the physical realm. And we have means for governing that. We have copyrights and patents that protect people's inventions and their literary or musical or artistic works. And a person steals when they violate that. We have digital media. We have opportunities to copy or duplicate materials that in many senses is a form of thievery. When I make photocopies of copyrighted material or I copy digital music files onto my iPod that I didn't pay for, or I watch pirated movies. And of course, we have this whole notion as well in Scripture of the possibility of stealing from God. The prophet Malachi talks about this. He was accusing the people of stealing from God. The idea being that when I owe someone something to someone and I don't give it to them or I use it for something else, I've stolen from them. So if I am renting and I take the rent money and I decide I'm going to instead go on vacation instead of giving the money to my landlord, I have essentially stolen from my landlord. And Malachi says that's the nature of your relationship with God. So we have all of these other forms of thievery. Well, what is the theological foundation? What's kind of going on here? What's the underpinnings? I mean, we would see that with murder, for example, that murder is particularly heinous because we are created in the image of God. To attack or perpetrate violence against another human being is to essentially attack God, to mar or vandalize his image. So what's the point with stealing? Why is it so reprehensible? I think the easiest way to state it is to simply say that we are stewards. Or we might even say slaves. That would be a good rendering. We have been purchased by the blood of Christ. We were in slavery to sin, in bondage, and God has redeemed us. That's a financial term. He's bought us back out of slavery. But the reality is, according to Romans 6, we now are His slaves. No longer slaves to sin, but slaves to righteousness. That's a privilege to be the slave of the Most High God. The High King. Isn't that what David says? I'd rather be a doorkeeper in the house of my God. I'd rather be a lowly servant than to be living high on the hog in the tents of the wicked. It's a privilege to serve God. But make no mistakes, we are stewards. We are slaves of God. And a steward manages property on behalf of the owner's interests. Right? So a steward has to answer for all of the allocation of all of the resources. Now a tenant is different, right? A tenant might pay the landlord a sliver, a portion, an allocation for rent. But then the tenant is able to take the rest of it and do what he pleases. But a steward is different. A steward has to give an account for the use of all of the resources. He is distributing these resources according to the master or the owner's directives. So this is the nature of our relationship to our goods. So we certainly have private property, right? This isn't to say that none of us own anything. That's the whole point of the command, right? Not to steal. So we have private ownership, and yet there's a sense in which we don't own anything absolutely. We've been entrusted with resources, but we will give an accounting for our use of those resources. I'm not simply free to do whatever I want with my money or with my resources. This is why Paul says in Ephesians 4:28, stop stealing. Instead, work with your hands so that you will have something good to share with those who are in need. So obviously you work and earn money to provide for your own needs, but there's more than that. God intends for us to earn money so that we can have a role in helping and fulfilling the needs of other people. That's a stewardship concept, all right? And I include a quote here from Chrysostom, one of the early church fathers, who reflected on that very thing. So implications, if that's the case, and again, we're used to thinking this way, or hopefully we're used to thinking this way, Jesus takes the command, and he keeps working back so that we see the intent of the command. So if we understand the sense of being stewards, being responsible for the use of our resources, that has some additional implications. One of those is that it's a sin to be wasteful. Right? It's a sin to waste what God intended to be used for other people. So I shouldn't fritter my money away or spend it thoughtlessly. I shouldn't allocate it in foolish ways. And I would just put before you this issue of gambling, which seems to sort of come in and out of vogue. The Southern Baptist Convention came out with what I think is a really good statement on why gambling is a sinful action, why it's wrong, why it's a violation of Christian stewardship. They say this: while the Bible contains no thou shalt not in regard to gambling, it does contain many insights and principles which indicate that gambling is wrong. The Bible emphasizes the sovereignty of God and the direction of human events. Gambling looks to chance and good luck. The Bible indicates that man is to work creatively and use his possessions for the good of others. Gambling fosters a something for nothing attitude. I hope I'll win it big, even though I've done nothing to earn it. The Bible calls for careful stewardship. Gambling calls for reckless abandon. The Bible condemns covetousness and materialism. Gambling has both at its heart. The moral thrust of the Bible is love for God and neighbor. Gambling seeks personal gain and pleasure at another person's expense. So it's a sin to be wasteful, to use what is God intended for us to steward for the good of others, and to waste it. We would also say that it's a sin to be greedy. If we understand this stewardship concept, right? It's a sin to hoard what God has intended to be used for others. So if I send one of my kids out with a plate of cookies to distribute to the other kids in the family, and that particular child chooses to eat all of them himself or herself, that's an act of stealing, isn't it? I mean, essentially it is. Those were not their cookies to eat, or at least not to eat them all themselves. So they were supposed to take them and distribute them. So it's a sin to be greedy. And I think this is a big one for us, to be honest, in the church. I think very often we have equated stewardship with saving. Okay, I'm going to meddle here, all right? I think a lot of people say, if I save some money on this, or I just spent as little as possible, I've been a good steward. Well, that might be part of it. But a good steward is called upon to do more than just not waste the money, right? He's called upon to allocate and use the money in accordance with the master's directives. So we know the master's heart. God's heart is for the care of his people. And if I choose to just hoard that and save it, that's not good stewardship. That's hoarding. That's selfishness. So when we understand this concept of stewardship, certainly it leads us to have to confront a couple of these other areas as well. Audience participation, let's look at the Heidelberg Catechism number 110. I think this is just a really good summary of the Eighth Commandment. So let me ask the question and I'll let you give the answer. Question, what does God forbid in the Eighth Commandment? And I just chose to highlight that last word, gifts, because I think that again colors it, doesn't it? That's the stewardship element. That's the fact that everything that I have is ultimately a gift from God. It's something I've been entrusted with. So we have that captured there even in that great statement. There's a lot of other issues here that are raised, which we're not going to have time to explore today. Are we obligated to give away all non-necessities? Right? In other words, I have resources to care for my basic needs, and then beyond that, I'm to steward those resources for the good of others. Does that mean I have to give away all non-necessities? Is it okay to splurge? I think at some level we have to say it is. The Bible talks a lot about feasting and celebrating. God put a pretty big emphasis on that. So there's certainly opportunities for joy, for fullness. But we have to sort of wrestle with that. What is the distinction between saving and hoarding? You know, we have to be able to discern that difference. And I think it's the most clear place we see it is Luke 12, the parable of the rich fool. This guy brings in this bumper crop. You know, what you need as a farmer is enough to provide for yourself until the next season, right? This guy brought in just a phenomenal crop, much more than he needed to carry him through. Instead of giving away the surplus or caring for the poor, he decides to build bigger barns to hoard so that he'd have enough set aside for seasons and years to come. So we have to discern that distinction between healthy patterns of saving and celebrating and then hoarding and selfishness. And that's not always easy to discern. I think we have to, as we close here, I want to touch on this title that I've given this teaching today. Some of you might have noticed it, Avoiding the Weasel Zone. I think we have to be aware of our capacity to manipulate others for our own benefit. Adam Scott, the director of the creator of the Dilbert cartoon series, coined this term. He talks about the weasel zone. He defines it this way: the gigantic gray area between good moral behavior and outright criminal activity. That's a pretty gigantic area, isn't it? He's saying so much of our time is spent in this weasel zone. We're maybe not doing something that's going to get us arrested, but we're working the system, oftentimes at someone else's expense. And he's thinking about it primarily in the workplace. He talks about the devious tactics of humans. He says, to err is human, to cover it up is weasel. Right? Being a weasel encompasses everything that we hate about our coworkers, as well as all the sneaky, time-wasting activities that we ourselves engage in just to avoid doing actual work. Shifting things off on other people. Again, getting ahead at someone else's expense. And this isn't just a workplace thing, right? It happens in our homes. I've got a few kids that would just as soon let others kind of carry the load, that will work the system to sort of get ahead at someone else's expense. It's alive and well in the church. I think we've got a lot of people that would just as soon allow the few to sort of support the missionaries and support the ministry of the church while they keep their resources and their ministry energies to themselves. You know, it's a way of sort of getting ahead at someone else's expense, if not sort of sharing in the load, the weasel zone. I had this terminology just circulating in my mind. And certainly, as we think about the intent of the commands, not just to forbid the physical act of taking something that isn't ours, but to understand what's going on. God's desire for us to love others, to respect others, to help others to flourish, instead of sort of taking from them, that I ought to be in a place to want to contribute to their well-being. I want to be doing what's good for them. And I want to avoid the weasel zone. I want to be as far over to this end of that spectrum as I can of moral righteousness and avoid any of the duplicity and the conniving that is so prevalent in our lives.